Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the Research VR podcast. Today, we're joined by Alex Culligan from Leap Motion. Hi, Alex.
Hey.
I was expecting for you to say hello there, but it's all good. And the usual cast and crew, Mr. Peter and Mr. Lekoff. I don't know why I always call you guys Mr. something. Just Peter and Chris and Oz. That's very what we should be called. Yes, Mr. Peter. It's like very scientific.
Yeah. Come on, we're scientists after all.
We are such scientists, we are.
Yeah.
I love it. It's true. That's how it all started. So, welcome to the Research VR podcast, Alex. We've been big fans of your work at Leap. Alex does a lot of the being a head writer, he does a lot of the writing that you see coming out of Leap Motion, including blog posts, including social posts, including essentially all things that get written and posted about the technology and about how to actually use it in a good and efficient way. So, I think back in 2015, there was such little literature. On VR, you guys were one of the first, and you know, you kind of started doing that. We'd love to have you write some interesting stuff for Upload. Actually, that would be really cool. Maybe a contributor piece.
That would be a lot of fun. I'd love to do that. Yeah, we should definitely talk about that after.
Yeah, definitely. Before we jump into all things Leap Motion, this week was pretty interesting because we released the article about the wireless TP-CAS HTC Vive accessory, which was really, really cool. We had an article up about it. We had like a couple of videos about it. We even brought in a gymnast acrobat from Cirque du Soleil to do ninja flips in VR wearing a Vive and see if that still worked and tracked and everything. And it freaking did. Which was insane.
Yeah, the videos look really impressive.
Like, I have one very important question. How did you make headset stay on his head when he was doing flips?
Duct tape chin strap, baby. Duct tape chin strap. We actually only...
That's secret.
We only implemented that like 3 hours into the shoot, but because it was just flying off. And like, I just posted a video actually on my Instagram of like him doing a flip and then landing and like grabbing the headset. It's like, oh, that really messed me up, man. Like, especially when he was doing handstands, like a lot of it is based on visual cues. And so he was like in a handstand, he's looking down, and you know how the Vive doesn't really stay on your face if you're looking downwards. He was like, oh, this is really weird, guys. Like, I can't do, I don't know how long I can hold this.
So do you guys get like Vive insurance or something?
I know that should be a thing at Upload. You know, you got to sign a waiver when you.
I mean, you guys not only push the limits of the hardware, but also of the humans.
That's right.
Human Vive interaction.
All the boundaries.
Yeah.
Yeah, but unfortunately or luckily, we also released in the same moment an episode that we recorded with Nicole from XMG and also
Dominic from NVIDIA.
Yeah, we're addressing the questions that you kind of in the same moment answered.
Yeah, you guys, that was an untimely episode probably, but I have a lot of thoughts about you guys' thoughts and concerns and your discussions, mainly being racist and not believing that Chinese can able to achieve such things coming
from
efficient Germans in Europe that can do everything so efficiently.
My point was that in China you don't need a lot of certificates for running a lot of bandwidth.
Forget the certificates. They're non-ionized radio waves. That's what 60 gigahertz band is. Okay, that's not from me. That's from one of the commenters that I read running about the article, and he sounded credible because he said non-ionized radio waves. And I'm
gonna... Okay. I'm
no, but there actually aren't many health concerns at all. It's definitely less dangerous than your phone.
No, I mean, I'm not speaking about the health concerns. I'm pretty sure it's not very dangerous.
Yeah,
for your health,
it's not.
But you still need all those weird, permissions to do Bluetooth. Like Apple right now had some issues with Bluetooth, right? So you need all those certificates for FTT stuff, whatever.
Go and watch the interview video that I did with the CEO. Because he addresses a lot of those concerns about the FCC, about doo-doo-doo-doo.
Well, he didn't state that it's yet done.
How about we focus on this particular topic in a devoted episode?
Yeah. We will.
And now we are coming back to our guest.
Exactly.
It's a very...
I'm finding this very entertaining.
It's a very entertaining topic. I mean, we all want it to happen. Not everyone believes. Now there is footage from Upload that it works.
It's real footage. I have side-by-side comparison shots and video. Actually, there's a good amount of video that hasn't been released yet. just because it was hard to sync and just, you know, fluff and whatnot. But yeah, there's a lot of really good footage that just shows how well it worked. Indistinguishable from the main thing, apart from every one, like maybe once or twice over the course of like an hour and a half of me using it that I noticed that it's like, oh, like there's some artifacts, like a stream went down from a 4K stream to like, you know, a 1440p stream or something, like at a particular part. And what I'm guessing is that they're doing some kind of compression in the periphery of the vision rather, and you know, keeping things unnoticeable that way, which is really smart. But that's me just completely speculating. I did not specifically look out for that. I wish I had, but this is after that. I had such a small, short period of time over a couple of hours, and I had to coordinate with a freaking Cirque du Soleil dancer to come in and shoot him and also do my impressions and also do video and also capture an interview. It was kind of a logistical nightmare, but it all worked out.
But hey, we will know more in the following weeks. Coming back to our lovely guest, Alex, how did you end up at Leap?
Actually, the CTO and I, David Halls, we go back a really long way. And I was brought on in late 2012 to just drive some of the thought leadership, even before our launch, just around like what the technology was, what its capabilities were, what it represented at the time. And then from there, it just kind of took off. I started doing the newsletters, and eventually around launch, I was handling most of the written content that was coming out of the company. And now nice. I manage the website. I manage a bunch of different aspects of how Leap Motion meets the world.
What's your background? So what did you do before Leap?
Social and political thought. I have a master's degree in it, actually. Did some work with the Special Olympics, was a features editor in my local paper.
Cool.
Yeah, a bunch of different things, just a little bit of work for Leap Motion, and then it just took off from there. It's been a really incredible few years.
And when you started working at Leap, did they already had the focus on VR? Because in the beginning, VR was not playing a big role, right?
That was back in 2012. Yeah, VR was still, you know, the virtual boy. It was that thing that had been tried and failed back in the 90s and even before that. Our big focus at the time was transforming how people interacted with their desktop. But then with the new VR renaissance, we kind of see that there's this huge opportunity and huge gap in terms of how people are going to interact with these new worlds. A lot of the design philosophies that have been sort of built up in desktop PCs that proved to be such a big barrier in our initial run have been entirely absent or irrelevant with VR. So it's really allowed us to make a major mark in a completely new emerging medium.
Well, in fact, I remember Azad Beg-Zahn had some kind of hackathon won when he used the Leap Motion, right?
Yeah, I did actually. That was
What was it about?
It was about, it's called Focus VR, and it was about recreating testing environments in VR so that you can learn, you can sit in them and study in the same seat that you would use to actually take the test in. So, you know, using the same environmental cues will help you with memory. There was a little bit of research on that that we wanted to test. But yeah, the Leap Motion was the thing that made it, because this was actually the time before the Vive and before Tiltbrush that we used the Leap Motion's tool tracking, which actually kind of is completely underused. You don't see anyone
totally
ever
agree.
Using it.
Totally agree.
Right? I think this is freaking awesome. So it comes up as a wand, and we created, you know, virtual whiteboard that you can write on. Yeah, it blew people away.
Yeah, we used actually the Leap Motion also for a small industrial demo where we, you know, had this typical stuff we were working on with the engineers, and where you would use your hands and actually grab objects and put them to the machine. So we all kind of have experience with Leap, but maybe we should, for our audience, maybe explain quickly what the Leap Motion is. How would you describe it, Alex?
Yeah, the Leap Motion technology is essentially two little infrared cameras and three LEDs. The cameras pick up video capture of your hands that are illuminated by the LEDs. The intensity of the LEDs is something like half the intensity of the sun of sunlight. And we use sophisticated algorithms to interpret that infrared image data and convert it into virtual hands. So it allows you to sort of reach out if you have one, you know, a Leap Motion controller mounted on an Oculus Rift or HTC Vive and you're running the right demo. You reach out and you see your hand in VR exactly the same way as you would in real life. Of course, in VR, you can do all sorts of really incredible magic things. Like we created a blocks demo that kind of allows you to pinch your fingers together and sort of spawn things from midair. You can grab them, you can throw them around, you can turn gravity on and off. You can express yourself in different social VR applications. Basically anything that you could use your hands for in the real world, you can do in VR.
And where do you see Leap Motion moving? So
Wait. Before we ask him that, I want to say a couple of things about the new mobile Leap Motion.
All right.
You guys, I just tried it out. It's freaking awesome.
Seriously. What exactly is it?
So it's the thing that you, it's a faceplate on the Gear VR currently.
Currently, yes. That's just a reference design though. Ultimately, it's going to be truly embedded. Dude,
truly embedded. Yeah. Can it get embedded on a Daydream phone? I don't know if...
I mean, we're talking to a number of different companies, but it's something that really has to be done sort of at the manufacturing level before it comes forward. The main thing is it's really important that it be something that's built in, like from the factory, before it even reaches anybody. Because if it's just an add-on device or a peripheral, then adoption just suffers. And it's kind of punishing for developers who, you know, maybe only 30% of people have it. So
and
what am I designing for?
To that point, you know, you're fragmenting users in terms of inputs. But I think if you do concentrate on mobile, which has a big problem with input systems currently. Every single mobile VR thing has a completely different way of doing it, and it requires an external pad to keep carry around. And Daydream, I think, is trying to do it, you know, pretty well with having a little the sensor or the remote inside of the headset that you slide back into. But I think, especially for mobile VR and AR, you know, hand tracking is going to be so crucial. Very excited to see, you know, where this is going to go. But I think I'd love to just talk about a little bit more on how it felt, how the tracking worked, how the FOV was like significantly improved. You guys, the FOV is now exactly what you're seeing. Like, I think it's a little bit wider.
Oh, it's wider. It's 180.
It's wider, right? Okay, so that goes out pretty damn far. I was testing it. It was like big box around me. And I was just twirling my hands, kind of like doing like a Macarena dance. Like, it was just working. And I was like, wow, like, how far have we come since, I think that the hackathon we did was like either December or January. And it was before the Orion update. You know, and like, seriously, in 12 months, there's been a huge amount of improvements over the past 4 or 5 years that you guys have had with the Leap.
Yeah,
especially with Orion. It was quite impressive to see that the same hardware that you released like 4 years ago, 5 years ago, could be that much improved just by software.
Well, this isn't the new the same hardware. This is a different piece of hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Although, it's the new one, yeah. Really, it's a different piece of hardware. But it's even now it's essentially the same tracking. There might be a couple of minor benefits with the new hardware as it stands now. We are going to sort of continue building out towards that. But it really is just at the level of software, and we've been able to accomplish things that were previously thought to be impossible within this decade. It's absolutely nuts.
With the new hardware, if you're using essentially the same components, you're just angling it in a slightly wider way, right? Because I know it's slightly angled down as well, so that it's looking at your hands rather than looking straight forward.
Some of the components are different, but I mean, ultimately what it is that you have software that's taking this infrared imagery and trying to make sense out of it. And there are, like I said, there are definitely advantages on the hardware side to like some new capabilities that come with that. But ultimately, the actual tracking experience, the ability to, you know, take these images and translate them into hands, that's still at the level of the tracking software. And it's...
I just sent a video around that is, well, maybe from your competitor, but I'm not sure if Microsoft is really your competitor. It's a research video that they show hand tracking and also finger tracking actually from a Kinect.
Oh, yeah.
And it's quite impressive. I recommend everyone to see the video because it shows that the device that maybe many of our listeners, you know, played around with.
That looks surprisingly good.
Exactly. There is also more information. I will link it in the article how they do it because it's also mobile, at least in theory, mobile optimated. And
that's actually, you know, depth. That's actual depth data. And that's a, what would you call it? Like a
point
mesh,
cloud.
A point cloud. Yeah, it's a point cloud rather than a mesh.
It's not a mesh. It's not a mesh, nor a point cloud. I will a link to it in a moment.
You are both wrong. I shall tell you how it
no,
is.
No. It's they do something else, something magical there.
Wait. You just triggered him, guys.
Wait a minute. Kinect hand tracking. Because what they do is they are not using a typical mesh approach. And this is what surprised me that much about it.
While you do that, Alex.
Yeah.
What? So you're talking about Leap being integrated down to the manufacturer and OEM level.
Right.
For it to actually work. I totally agree. Where are you guys with the Chinese manufacturers? Because there's a lot there. There's so much there. And especially with you're selling your Leap Motions currently, you know, like $60 maybe? Like
80
something
bucks.
Like that? 50? 80? Okay. I see it dip down a lot.
There are some third-party resellers, but yeah, it's still 80 right. bucks.
But like, you know, where are we with integrating with China, with the Chinese, with China?
Oh, yeah, the topic just comes up.
But you.
Oh, there you go. we're talking to everybody. Absolutely everybody. I mean, I can't really
China.
Comment. Yeah. It's,
I'm sorry. I just like saying China. like Donald Trump.
God. What are you going to integrate with China? The whole country.
No, guys, this is not a political podcast.
No, it's not politics. Please, it's just it's the truth that they make every single... No, I mean, it's the truth. They make all of the headsets, first of all, and they're currently, like, if you're looking at what's being sold in China in terms of headsets, there are a ton of sub-$100, sub-$50 headsets that are being sold right now for, you know, the Christmas sales. Xiaomi is making their own headset, Huawei, I mean, every single phone
maker. But it's technically just a daydream stuff, just daydream.
It's cardboard, yeah, it's cardboard, not even daydream. Yeah.
It's built on the cardboard SDK, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, what I can really say is that we're talking to everybody, but at the same time, it's really important that whatever partners we have and whatever experiences we integrate with are going to be like of a high quality. Like this is sort of the testing ground, and right. if somebody has like a really bad experience with Leap Motion, then that kind of reflects really badly on what's an emerging technology yep. in the space. Whereas if they have a really great experience, then that's what we're aiming for. I will say there are some there are also impressive technologies and impressive headsets coming out of China. So I think it's a mix. It's like with anything. It's, you know, you
but
have
not only impressives. I mean, when I was in Silicon Valley and I have been, you know, at a few conventions and they were literally next to your stand, Chinese clones, they didn't really manage to make it run in front of me, right? So, I mean, there is some kind of very impressive hardware, especially Xiaomi is pushing the realms very much, but also a lot of very strange hardware. I just posted actually the paper in the Hangouts, so we will link to it, and it shows how they reconstruct it. And it's not based on mesh, but it's based on some weird mass, and if you are able to understand mass, just read the paper.
So if you understand 3D vector math, then you will be able to understand this. Yeah, that's it's really cool. I think I've seen a few of the other papers, especially about the interactions. It might have even been this video.
Yeah. Very impressive about them is basically that you don't need many iterations to get the hand. But my point is not that Microsoft solved it, but that Microsoft managed to do something with hardware that's maybe 8 years old. Something quite impressive.
Yeah.
And it's showing the software part.
Yeah, it really does come down to software. You can do some really incredible stuff with off-the-shelf components. I mean, as far as our own particular approach, we take the approach that we have because we have sort of three things that we want to be able to achieve. We want to be able to achieve as low latency as physically possible in this universe.
Mm-hmm.
Low cost.
Where are we with that?
It's pretty close. We were able to... Geez, with the tracking software on the mobile platform, we were able to cut it down like to a tenth of the of the processing time it was previously.
Sweet.
Yeah, we're really? Talking. Yeah, sub millisecond. It's
Wow. Wait. So tell us a little bit more about that. How have we made such a leap from what Leap Motion was a year ago to seriously? Yeah. I mean that's that latency is a very very hard problem to solve, especially with external peripheral attachments that have to have their own processing.
I mean, I can't really go too much in the details about that. Partially because I'm going to be honest. I mean, I don't entirely understand it myself because we have some really incredible talent over in our tracking team. But yeah, essentially, it's just been continually optimizing it. One part of it is our LeapC API, which is, you know, written to be closer to the metal than any of our previous APIs, which were sort of, you know, done through Swig. So it kind of had to like pass through that in order to get around. And yeah, it's just a matter of continuously optimizing the software as we were, you know, building towards, you know, Snapdragon 820 as our as our reference chip.
Okay, so what phones currently are running on a 820?
The S6?
The S7, I think.
S6, I think, also.
Any other phone manufacturers that are using, you know, the same processor?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the Snapdragon series is, you know, in wide use.
Right.
Yeah. There must be about 20 phone models out there using it.
Yeah. Nice.
I think Pixel has it, right? Or does the Pixel use a 835? I'm not sure.
You should
fact check on that, because what I'm trying to get to the bottom of here is what can this be integrated into that you're not telling us?
Human beings.
I know.
Oh,
businesses. Yeah, I think everyone that's, you know, at least familiar with this podcast and listening to it is very familiar with Leap and has used it and developed with it at some point. So it's a very, you know, homey feeling. I'd say a year ago, everyone kind of had a Leap on their DK2. That was the standard across many. And I see it becoming a huge part of the future, even if it's not currently being as implemented as it was before. Because I think the use cases just haven't permitted for it to be like, this is right now the first wave of people coming into VR, and it really, really is the gaming that's pushing it forward. And it's hard to do too much with just hands, but there's so much, I think, the other 80% of the pie that would benefit from just natural interactions and not having to explain buttons to people. I see that
here in the discussion, I have a question to Alex. Did you do any user testing of the prolonged usage of Leap Motion? So like a 2-hour session with Leap Motion or that sort of thing?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Good question.
I mean, geez, internally, we dog food practically everything. we use our own stuff pretty much continuously. And one of the big design challenges, of course, we keep running into is this, you know, issue. It's been called Gorilla Arm. It's also been called just the minority interface problem, which is if you have your arms stuck out in front of your face and you're waving them around for long periods of time, your arms get really tired. So when you're designing an experience that involves your hands, you have to do a mix of different types of interactions. You can do the broad sweeping ones, but you have to sort of keep them in reserve. Mostly, if you can do sort of more fine-tuned, granular interactions, ones that are sort of at the level of your breastbone so that the blood is able to sort of continue pumping up and down your arm without it all sort of rushing down if you have it held way up and like at the level of your face, it tends to work a lot better. There's a lot of other, you know, good practices around that too. Like people need to be able to disengage from what they're doing without, you know, everything flying out of control. They should be able to alternate between different types of tasks so they can work different muscles.
Since you are designing or advising to design the interaction on slightly lower level, like the head should be below your face, do you also bend the sensor a little to point down?
Well, that's interesting. Azad mentioned that earlier. The sensor on the mobile platform is angled slightly downwards. Although, even if it wasn't, you'd still be able to get pretty robust tracking even, you know, down in front of your chest.
Okay.
That's cool. I think what was really interesting about the prolonged usage question is I want to think, you know, I want to talk a little bit more about embodiment of hands, especially with the touch now out. The touch really, really feels like it's another level of input. Probably not, I mean, not as much as you'd get with a Leap Motion, I'd say, because using the Vive for so long, like I got so used to just sterile hands, and the touch brought a little bit of motion to my fingers, and I was like, oh, I forgot what it was like to have this. It's like a breath of fresh air. But with Leap, I mean, what have you seen? Have you actually, I mean, I'm guessing you have a wide view over, you know, what developers have created on the Leap. Have you seen much when it comes to people having like fire or like pokey things or something poking into your hand and like seeing if you can feel that. I remember there was a spider's experience way back. It was like, what was it called? Don't move your hand
don't
or something?
Move,
was,
yeah. Don't or, move. Don't let go. Don't let go.
Don't let go. Yeah. It's so great. You have to hold down the control buttons on the keyboard.
I remember that. That one was amazing. It's got like at the end, it's got the velociraptor that walks in the room. Oh, that's a lot of fun. No, actually, it's kind of funny you mentioned that, because the developers of Tilt Brush, before they built that, they had actually done some work with us and had created a demo called Plasma Ball. And at one point, there was a VR version of Plasma Ball. It's sort of buried in the mists of time now. I think it was like on Oculus 0.5 or something like that. Mm-hmm. Although the desktop version of it is still available. And it's really cool, glowing electrical Tesla orb. And you sort of reach out and it makes this sort of deep thrumming noises. And then you touch, then your hand approaches it and it touches it. And, goes, and you can see like there's lightning arching into your hand. And between the visual effects and the immersion of being in the space and just the sound, we saw videos of, you know, people's moms who they'd be trying it out and they'd be like terrified to touch it, and they would shriek and jump back when the when their hands approached it, just because when you get this combination of sound and visuals, it can really fool your brain in a really surprising way. And that was actually kind of a revelation for me, because I saw that and I'm like, wow, you know, that's the reality of virtual reality, where you can really, even just for an instant, you know, this was on the DK1, but still for an instant, really believe that there's this thing that can't really exist in the real world, but it exists in front of you right now. And you can feel it in your fingertips, even though there's nothing there.
That's fascinating. I wish, you know, more people created things that interacted with your hands in that way, because I think you can add a lot of weight to certain actions and certain menu items that you can touch by having that visual interaction with your hand itself, of like almost
basically, you know, embodied cognition, right?
Yeah, exactly.
When you interact with the world around you, you feel way more in there, right?
Wouldn't it be just a wow effect? Wouldn't the fact that you actually don't have any other than visual feedback over a long time decrease the value of this experience? So if I don't have any force feedback when I press a button, or somebody is burning my hand in virtual reality but it doesn't feel hot in the real world, besides the wow effect in the beginning, later on is rather disappointing.
You think so?
I don't know if I would say it's disappointing at all. I think it's more that it creates a new set of expectations around sort of how this other world works. You get a mental model of how the physics in a particular universe works through, you know, repeated experimentation. And over time, it creates those expectations in your mind, and your brain creates those new connections about, like, okay, this is a thing, and it behaves in this certain way, and I can sort of smack it around, and it's going to sort of respond in that way consistently. And
right.
It fits into this conceptual category.
And I think keeping it slightly inconsistent is a very big advantage, because that's the beauty of the interaction, is that you want to have...
uncanny valley. You don't want to reach the interaction.
No. I'm talking about novelty of interactions, of like, there's certain things that you just play with like for 20 minutes in VR, and you're like, this is really fun, because there's a certain amount of unpredictability. It's a fine balance of predictability and then having the unpredictability for novelty, and that's why it's fun to play with balloons in VR, or, you know, like the silly stuff. So I think, you know, maybe there's something to like keeping the visual. It might diminish your, like you're saying, Christoph, over time, but if you do have a certain bit of like wobbliness to it, of weird physics that you can interact with. Dude, perfect example. Go download My Room from Khabibo. So Khabibo's this awesome physics artist, VR artist type of thing. Really cool. He's like a physicist, but also an artist. And so he creates this like insanely different worlds that have weird physics properties. And so he did a photogrammetry scan of his room, and then Bill put it in Unity, put it on a Vive, and you actually jump in there, and then your hands turn into black holes, and you suck the frickin', dense point cloud out of the wall, and it warps back. People have spent hours. I've spent up to an hour in there doing it, and it's that unpredictability of how it's going to interact. That, I think, is like still so untapped. Yeah. Very little I've seen from there.
But I mean, if you kind of, you know, imagine someone who is, you know, playing with computers and working with computers for a long time, you would kind of say, okay, you would aim at the effectivity. So you would not use anything else in the bash, right? And some people are just using the bash, but I use the bash occasion.
What's the bash?
Okay, the command line, yeah.
Oh, sorry.
For non-Linux users, the command line, so you would, you know, just see a green and enter. Yes. Yeah. But I still enjoy all those nice and beautiful effects, for example, of macOS, right? So, I mean, the windows kind of flop out and you can do this four fingers movements. I mean, it is not adding any functionality, really.
It adds the functionality.
Well, it is.
Complete function behind
but
it.
You could do it completely from the command line. You can, and more effectively.
You guys.
It makes more fun.
Are we really having a discussion about that if GUI is effective rather than bash command line? I think we're not stuck in the 70s.
Yes, exactly. Wait. I wanted to do a segue to the blog post that Alex wrote about menus in VR.
So the one from this morning?
Yes.
Beyond Flatland.
That's why I actually, you know, started this weird conversation.
I love this type of topics, actually. Let's talk about GUIs.
No, but Alex, could you elaborate a little bit more on the articles that we just tried to segue?
Very awkwardly, I might add.
So 70s calls, they want their bash back.
I think you had some good points in there. I mean, there really is a big difference, though, between, creating interactions that really feel compelling and sort of take you in another universe and things that are just sort of flourishes. I think in UX design right now, the word delight has been overused to death and
presence. Did someone say empathy? What? Excuse me? I'm sorry. I'll stop talking.
That might have to be the subject of that guest post, actually. Top 100 overused words. There's a number of things in the post for the audience. That's beyond Flatland on the Leap Motion blog. Google it.
We will put it in show.
Yeah, please paste it in here so that I can read it too.
Yeah, we'll do. So essentially, what we've seen over the last 20 years has been this gradual flattening of interfaces. So you have, back in the 90s, you had these sort of skeuomorphs, very prominent drop shadows, 3D objects and effects. User interfaces for the PC, like back in, 92, 93, were all designed to be as physical as possible so that people would understand, like, I'm supposed to click this thing, but I'm not supposed to click this thing. This thing is going to do something for me and this thing will not. Since then, we've seen just a constant flattening out. So, particularly in web design, where all of the 3D effects, all of the drop shadows, all of that stuff has sort of gone away in favor of, very flat, transitions between screens, transitions between things, gradients, because we already know what a hyperlink is. So we don't need to have it be this particular shade of blue and underline it. We already know what a menu is supposed to do. So we can hide it behind a hamburger stack on mobile and people understand what it is. The thing is, in VR, we don't have any of that.
Are you in France? This sounds like a French... no? Oh, okay. Oh, wait, that was from Germany.
Well, in Canada, so close
Canada,
enough.
Canada, I was going to say.
Sorry.
So, in VR, we're sort of back in the skeuomorphism stage where we have these, very physical things that are being developed. And Oculus Quill actually came out really recently is a good example. It's a very simple, very direct interface. It looks extremely old school. It looks like something you'd see at a Windows 3.1, but it's super clean and it works really well because it's so physical.
Except the fat fingers effect. The elements in this menu are so small that, for me, with so precise tracking as Oculus Touch has, it's actually hard to choose some options. I make a lot of choice mistakes.
Yeah, you really
cannot point correctly.
You really need buttons to be like a good, like nearly an inch, if not wider, in VR because of that effect. Otherwise, you're just like Homer Simpson mashing on the telephone.
Yeah.
But yeah, so I think what we're getting towards now in VR is kind of something outside of the flat skeuomorphic spectrum, and skeuomorphs are these physical metaphors sort of brought over from the physical world to help us understand a digital interface. We've moved away from skeuomorphism and towards flat design on the web and on our PCs. But with VR, it's going to come down more to a series of essential cues. You have depth in VR, you have space, you have these things that exist in a world around you. So the way that they're laid out and the way that they relate to each other within that space suggests more about their use than almost any other cue that you could try to use. So things can look and act and behave like buttons, but you can also do some really, you know, reality bending things that would look weird or ridiculous on a flat screen, but in VR it feels like it works.
Moving from the 80s to the 90s, there was actually, I remember, a project from the Vive, from Bill Gates, where they wanted to somehow build a real desktop. So you would kind of have
a real desktop.
Yeah, a real desktop. You would actually have a real desk on your screen, and you would click with a mouse instead of, you know, the typical folders on real folders or books. That's where this clamp that you coming from. It was from the, what is she called, the wife of Bill Gates, Melinda Gates. Yeah, and she was leading the department that were trying to, I mean, going exactly in the same direction as you just described. Basically, instead of having the desktop we know right now on Windows, have a desk standing there and also objects, and you could click on them and have, you know, things interact with you, like the clamp talking with you and stuff. And they very quickly moved away from it because it didn't make sense for a desktop. But could you imagine that we would go that direction again in VR?
I mean, it's entirely possible. It's just, I hope that we can, I hope that our experience with PC, you know, the PC digital universe is going to help us sort of accelerate beyond that and reach interfaces and reach realities that we can scarcely even imagine right now. There are some really exciting experiments out there.
Help or disrupt?
It's difficult. I think in part that's kind of why we ended up naming the series on the Leapmotion blog Explorations in VR Design. We had the VR best practices, but after we published that, we came to realize, like, there's almost no VR best practice that you can name except for, you know, don't make your users sick. Everything else is, you know, everything else is constantly being overturned because we're all sort of reaching towards what it is that we're trying to achieve. We're trying to articulate the world that we're trying to build at the same time. And there's really incredible innovation in the space. So with the new series, it was Explorations because it's, you know, what's happening in this space and what are people doing?
We got to read this. That's actually a great point that it is very, you know, obviously experimental. It's even at this stage. And even the trends that I am seeing, emerge are still being essentially fought against or innovated against. And that's actually perfect. Like you do need a certain amount of trends and things that you could familiarize yourself with, but it's still so early to actually just stick to doing it one way. One trend that I actually would love to bring up that I've just been seeing over the past month or so is the walkie behavior and on the Vive game. So locomotion, I think for the past year on the Vive has just been stuck to teleportation, which is, you know, kind of disappointing for a ton of the gamers that are now coming into VR because they want to move. I mean, that's not the only reason why teleportation has issues, obviously. But so to that point, I've been seeing a lot of the walkie motion, as in you hold the grip buttons and then you start doing a walking motion and you move forward. It actually, you know, if you put a good amount of gain to it and you do the interaction in a good way, it actually feels really good and not motion sickness inducing at all. And I've seen countless games already integrated, from Climby to Lucid Trips, Art of the Fight. I just tried the Fist of Physics, a couple other games that are just, you know, that just came out recently all have it. And I think that's a really cool way of, you know, that's a trend that's emerging and it's also being fought against in terms of teleportation.
If
there are any master or bachelor students who are looking for the topic, I would totally recommend just using a bunch of those games that are already on Steam and just check how long it takes for people to say, I get motion sick.
Yeah.
And then just compare across different games, different tracking different locomotion systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I think what it is that we're still we're still working on, you know, precisely what types of gameplay will make people feel sick and which ones won't. You know, I don't remember who it was, but I remember there was an insight that it was acceleration or deceleration rather than, you know, rather than movement itself that tended to cause the issue. So if you sort of transitioned almost instantly from not moving to moving, even if the movement itself was artificial, you didn't have this artificial acceleration, deceleration, so it didn't throw off your vestibular system.
You know, I think to that point, I mean, I agree with it and it'll cause less motion sickness, but I think that I would love to experience the acceleration and deceleration just to see what it's like. I don't get motion sickness at all, but like it almost feels a bit uncanny and unnatural to just like lunge forward like that. Surprisingly, I actually really dig the way Onward does its motion with just clicking on the thumb pad. And then if you want to run, you like click more forward and then you're kind of like moving a little bit quicker. There's no acceleration, deceleration in that either.
Best thing to test it with, Unity VR Editor, experimental edition that they just released.
Oh, I haven't tried that yet.
Oh man, let's do a whole episode about that. Actually, I just downloaded it. I haven't.
We need to wait for the next version. The current one is interesting, but it's definitely not deployable version.
Really?
No, I mean our main developer just said, guys, I cannot use this. I just got motion sick in less than 5 minutes.
Okay, but our main developer gets a lot of motion sickness.
Yeah, but it's very natural. You actually move there with the touchpad on the Vive controller. You press the touchpad and then...
Oh, come on, just close your eyes.
That's fine. Good, though. I mean,
that's a strange
thing. That's good.
That's your canary in your coal mine right there.
Yes, but since it's a touchpad, you very often press it accidentally. So you do a lot of accidental movement in Unity VR Editor. But spoiler alert, you should try it yourself and then we can discuss it.
Anyway. Okay. Let's start wrapping this up, guys. We don't want to run it too late in people's times. So any final thoughts, Alex, before we depart from our wonderful friends with Research VR?
Main thing is the explorations in VR series is only just starting. Would really love to hear what people think about it, especially since I want to put together like a new showcase in 2017 and update it. So really, if folks want to check it out and let me know what they think. If there's anything I missed, I'm constantly looking for new examples, leap motion and non-leap motion examples as well.
Cool, I like it.
You're stuck in a very similar situation as we are because we are also always asking for feedback. What did we miss?
That's right.
What could we improve? What was good? So, you know, go out and read his blog, listen to my thoughts.
How often are you posting on the blog?
About once a week.
Once a week. Cool. What's the next post that people can be expecting to be coming from Leap? Like, let me pull up the drafts here. See what I can bullshit through.
We are working on, some questions that people have had around the mobile platform. Mm. Some of them have been sort of dealt with in media reports. Other ones are just sort of trying to talk a little bit more about our roadmap and what our vision for the future is.
Cool.
There is going to be a post dedicated specifically to locomotion, storytelling and narrative, multiplayer VR, all kinds of stuff.
Fantastic.
Ultimately, this series is probably going to wrap up around GDC.
GDC. Well, yeah. Looking forward to seeing you there. How can people... Sorry, Peter.
That was exactly my question. How can people reach you? I was about to ask the same.
Yeah. You can hit us up on Twitter at Leap Motion. Go to the Leap Motion blog and leave a comment or email me at acolgan@leapmotion.com.
Awesome. And did you mention your Twitter? Or do
not
you
really
do the tweets?
I don't actually do much of the tweets. I'm actually running point on the Leap Motion Twitter quite a bit anyway. So
nice.
Hit me up at Leap Motion and I'll answer you.
Post some funny videos and tag Leap Motion in it.
Yeah, we just need to fill the office with cats.
All right, guys. Thank you all for joining another episode of the Research VR podcast. Stay tuned. Next episode will be pretty interesting. I think it'll be Chris Miranda from Enter VR and I, as well as my co-host for the VR for Good podcast, which hasn't launched yet, but will be soon. Erica Barraza from Singularity. And we'll be talking about 100 hours in VR spent in one session that Chris Miranda did. Kind of a crazy guy, but a great crazy guy. So thank you, Alex. Thanks to Peter. Thank you, Chris, for everybody being here.
It was a pleasure.
It really was.
Definitely. Thanks so much.
Do this again. Bye.
Goodbye. See you.